Welcome to the FutureCast, the Institute for the Future's ongoing conversation about signals of emerging innovations and disruptions that will make the future.
All right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the very first FutureCast, IFTF's monthly podcast. Today is November 20th, 2009, and I'm Jerry Mikulski, host. With me virtually are several senior IFTFers, Kathy Vion, Lynn Jeffries, and Rachel Hatch, as well as our guest, Art Brock. We will be holding these calls monthly, but not on a set schedule. We'll post the podcast to iTunes and the IFTF site. Our hashtag is FutureCast, and you can participate on a live chat if you've joined us on Skype. It's going right now. Please feel free to forward information about these calls to anyone who might be interested. And one last request, when you do jump into this conversation, please say your name each time so we know who's speaking. Today's call is about alternative currencies, which go under lots of different names. I think that's where we're going to start the conversation. Art Brock is, among other things, the founder of the Metacurrency Project. And Art, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. I think a good place to start might be if you could help us map the landscape of alternative currencies and all the other names that they go by.
Okay. The currencies are certainly known by a lot of different names. I think complementary currencies has become the most popularized term. I know I've actually been pushing for something more along the lines of targeted currencies, but they're also known as local currencies and community currencies. And in the way that we're talking about targeted currencies, I think we're referencing a much broader range of things than many other people might think of in the word currency. We're trying to reclaim the word currency to be a little bit of a broader term than money, even though, you know, in daily use we tend to use them interchangeably, to really reflect its origins coming from the same root as currents, you know, the Latin correre, to run, to flow. So it's the tools for managing those types of flows. And flows of goods and services, exchanges of goods and services, is something that money focuses on, but there's a lot of other important flows.
What kinds of flows have been currented in different ways?
Have been currentied or?
Yeah, currentied, currented, whatever the verb is, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Reputation currencies, I think, are a good example of something that, generally speaking, if you want to have a good reputation currency, it actually shouldn't be exchangeable, or you can basically buy your reputation, which
right.
kind of negates the purpose of a reputation currency. So all the kinds of reputation currencies that we use in the form of certifications or, degrees or anything, we're just trying to certify that something has a particular quality or, you know, skill or achievement level or something like that is an example of a kind of currency that's formalized, and it creates different kinds of flows of trust or things like that.
And those should not be exchangeable. That makes a lot of sense. And what about things like frequent flyer miles or your bonus points on your credit card or IOUs or other sorts of things? Are those considered currencies? Are they near currencies? Are they pseudo currencies? What is their role?
In my definition of currencies, those certainly qualify as currencies. Just to clarify, my definition is a formal system for shaping, enabling, and measuring currents. And those are formalized systems. Frequent flyer miles, you know, you get frequent flyer miles for each mile you fly, and maybe you get bonus miles if you purchased online and that kind of thing. And then there's rules about how they can be redeemed. You know, similar things if you have a formal system for anything along those lines, for IOUs, your buy nine, get your 10th cup of coffee free card is a kind of currency.
And which is recognized only by one store.
Right.
So how does that, can you walk us through how that scales on a local basis, things like local currencies?
I'm sorry, you were very garbled at the end there.
I'm sorry.
Can I walk you through how that scales?
Yeah. How do we go from the local currency that is the buy nine coffees, get one coffee free, to the Ithaca Hours program or other kinds of things that operate across many merchants in a region?
Well, first of all, I want to say that not all currencies should scale.
Mm-hmm.
that in a, my vision of a future with us having reclaimed our currency making capacities, then what that means is we create currencies to fill different niches as appropriate, and not all of those niches are about scaling. But yeah, there's definitely a leap that occurs when you go from, you know, an individual merchant creating a gift certificate or a buy nine get your 10th free card or, you know, something like that, to an agreement in a community to have a currency that operates a certain way. Something that we are starting in Denver is a kind of recirculating gift certificate among local businesses. And that functions like a currency, but it scales beyond just the individual store.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, how did we get to the point where we have fiat currencies and very few local currencies or alternative currencies? I mean, it's funny because we're talking here about frequent flyer miles, and I just read a couple of days ago that apparently the number of frequent flyer miles banked makes it one of the top, maybe the second largest currency system in the world. So saying that there isn't a lot of alternative currency may be misspeaking here, but how in the progress of economic development and the creation of fiat money and fiat currencies, how do we get to where we are?
Yeah, I mean, if everybody would indulge me just for a moment of setting a really big context. I think that, my interest in currencies actually has to do with living systems. That I think that what makes living systems alive are the flows. So if you consider for a moment the difference between a corpse and a human being, mm-hmm. you know, there's a set of flows that have particular integrity when you have a human being. And as soon as any of those flows are disrupted for a period of time, you end up having a corpse. And I think that we have become very fixated on a world of objects and not so much fixated on, not so given so much attention to the world of living systems. And we don't realize what the flows are that the integrity of are required to actually have a functioning community or a functioning economy or a functioning country or planet, and that we have inadvertently ended up with corpses of communities at times or countries. And, you know, the concern, of course, is that we can end up with a corpse of a planet. Mm-hmm. And that if flows and managing the integrity of those flows are what keeps living systems alive, currencies become very vital, much more so than they even seem, and they already seem pretty vital. You know, money seems pretty influential. And I think that actually has to do with a kind of evolution of our own capacities, our own expressive capacities. You could even think of it as kind of an evolution of language, where currencies are kind of a future step in our evolution of language, where we speak sentences, a currency as a kind of sentence in this language that is itself a living, adapting thing that affects, that lives beyond just the speaking of the sentence. It takes on a life of its own and shapes flows and interactions and everything beyond that. And you can see, in some respects, if you start taking that perspective, I realize what I'm talking about is kind of a somewhat abstract, ethereal thing. If you start taking that perspective, you can see how money has been so powerful in shaping our culture, our economy, our planet, and how powerful these kinds of tools can be. And I think what we're teetering on right now is this edge between the industrial age and the information age. And all of our systems and our currencies are still industrial age currencies and industrial age economic models. And we're in the midst of a significant shift as those things have kind of run their course. And as those living sentences that have been spoken of types of currencies, as those die, we need whole new sets of systems to create the healthy flows for our communities and economies. So that for me is the big picture and big context.
And so I just finished reading Life, Inc. from Doug Rushkoff recently, and he talks a lot about the creation of currencies, and I don't know whether his perspective is a little too tight on what happened, but he basically talks about how monarchs were getting aced out of the flow of all these local currencies that had emerged and wanted to effectively lock down their position of advantage and their relationship with the aristocracy and the mercantile class. So they effectively outlawed all local currencies and forced everyone through this system. Am I projecting onto what you're saying by saying that that act is what shut down all those natural flows and centralized them into these larger fiat currencies, and that was the start of this kind of suffocation of the flows, maybe?
I don't know as much about the history in that era, in that context. I too, am familiar with Rushkoff's work, and I'll take some of what he's saying at face value that occurred. But I know that it has occurred more recently in history. It actually occurred during the Depression, when lots of communities, there were literally thousands of currencies created in communities in the United States that emerged. And there was this whole possible path out of the Depression that involved these currencies. What they were called at the time, what they were referred to by the government at the time, were emergency currencies. I think somebody liked the rhyme, but apparently the head of the Federal Reserve went into a closed-door meeting with Roosevelt at the time, and he came out of that meeting and announced, the New Deal, the plan for the New Deal, and outlawed emergency currencies. So it's happened in more recent history to maintain the control of, centrally controlled currencies.
And we saw emergencies in Argentina and other countries that had hyperinflation recently cause the emergence of a lot of local currencies as well. But it seems like there's always this switch back to fiat currency.
Well, I think fiat currency definitely, national currencies are definitely a winner in the industrial age. I think the very nature of change that's occurring and the degree to which change is accelerating will actually soon leave behind many of the kinds of models, even organizational models and all that kind of stuff that are based more on centralized control and, clear hierarchy, chain of command kind of thing, because the whole sort of Web 2.0 consciousness, the difference between making Wikipedia and making some other encyclopedia, has proven that self-organization can adapt so much more quickly. And I think we're going to see the slow accretion of the kind of living systems, self-organizing systems, replacing the centrally controlled, centrally organized systems, including currencies.
So I love what you're saying, and I want to dive back into it, but I also want to give you a moment to talk about open money and the Metacurrency Project and what the different pieces of the platform are that you're building there. And then I think we can go back toward, okay, what does that mean in terms of the transformation from the current regime of fiat currencies into the kind of world that you're describing now. So would you just give us the description of open money?
Sure. I'm not highly active in the open money project. I'm more active in metacurrency, but we are very much, I think, attuned to a similar vision of bringing open source sensibilities and decentralized power and control to the space of currencies. I think the difference in focus is that open money, you can hear it in its name, is focused more on market currencies, medium of exchange currencies, monetary currencies. And what we're doing with metacurrency is trying to build something that can move outside of just the market economy into the social economy and gift economies as well, to facilitate things in those domains, reputation currencies and all of that. What we're doing in the Metacurrency Project is basically building new infrastructure, some of which requires whole new approaches to computing, to build an open source economy, to actually have currencies become able to be decentralized. And one of the things that that means is, like, you have a bank account, but the bank is really the authority about your bank account. You have no authority. If you disagree with your bank about what your balance is, you're kind of screwed. You have to work pretty hard to try to prove something different, and even then, they still may not agree, and they still may not comply. You end up in lawsuits or, you know, whatever. You actually have no control over your own account. And what part of what we're doing in these whole distributed systems is giving the capacity for you to be an authority in representing your accounts, and knowing that when you do represent your accounts, the data can't be tampered with. So that requires whole new even approaches to structuring data, where you have these linked chains of digitally signed transactions, so you can't tamper with them. You can't pull out any transactions or insert new ones, or it breaks the chain. So you can at any point kind of produce an audited state of your accounts.
Cool. And what other features, either in the Metacurrency project, what shape does it have that people could dig into and join in, for example?
Yeah, that's a little tricky. This is one of the things we've been talking about. The Metacurrency project has been, it's very focused toward geeks at the moment that want to help build these tools. And so we have a couple of other places more loosely coupled with the Metacurrency project. There's the New Currency Frontiers, which is a kind of wiki site where people can participate there in the discussing more about the ideas behind all of this stuff. We're kind of keeping metacurrency.org free of the ideological and philosophical discussions and keeping it just focused on geeky infrastructure stuff, of how do we build these tools. And there's also blog.newcurrencyfrontiers that you can see updates on. And we are scheming at the moment about creating a kind of community of practice of currency practitioners, currency designers. If you want to look at how to, you know, bring this into your community or your business and that kind of thing, and creating a kind of currency designer guild.
Mm-hmm. And how is this happening geographically? How is this broadening around the world? Where is the interest? Where is the traction?
It is pretty global. The participants in the Metacurrency project, the sort of dozen or so that are kind of on our core weekly conference calls and that kind of stuff, we've got ones in, you know, across the United States and in Mexico and France and the Netherlands and trying to think where else. We don't really have any common people from, we don't have people on the calls commonly from Asia yet, but for being such a small group, it's pretty far flung.
Interesting. Let me bring the IFTF folks into the call so they can kind of join us and ask questions and so forth. We have got Kathy, Lynn, and Rachel, and actually several other people from IFTF as well, but Kathy, did you want to, let me just go in order and see if you guys have different questions you'd like to ask.
Well, hi, Arthur. This is really fascinating to me, and I'm really interested in the, obviously, with the Institute, sort of the long range and sort of big social and economic implications, which I think you're getting to in some really interesting, using some really interesting metaphors of flows and things like that. What I'm wondering is if we could follow on for a minute with Jerry's sort of last question about how global is this, and ask if, you know, we've seen over the last couple of decades a lot of conversation and some reality about a digital divide in the kind of internet-based distributed currency systems that you're thinking about, are they subject to that same kind of divide? Does it have a kind of technological sort of bent gateway that people have to get through in order to participate?
Well, certainly not all currencies do. I mean, you can use bits of paper and tokens and things like that. What we're doing with the MetaCurrency project is trying to build new infrastructure for managing these things electronically, but, you know, being able to interface with them through your cell phone or through a phone call or anything like that is also completely viable as part of it. We're definitely not trying to increase the digital divide. And I think as we see, you know, cell phones becoming more and more pervasive in more and more countries, even developing nations, that kind of thing, that that is plenty enough to be able to fully engage with these types of currencies. That level of technology is enough.
So another sort of question that I had was about risk and managing risk in this kind of a system. We typically think of banks as, I mean, one way to think of them is as a means of managing risk. Have you thought about how risk gets managed in a decentralized, distributed system like you're proposing?
Yeah. First of all, there's the whole issue of people confusing centralized control with stability and making sure that we address the issue of just the functional stability, that the decentralization of it in no way compromises the sustainability or stability or, you know, anything like that of the system itself. That's one aspect where people, you know, are just used to the pattern of thinking, well, if a very few people are controlling it all, then it's safer. So what we're having to do is essentially build those controls into the architecture itself so that being able to have the data be shared or have, you know, having no central point of failure, that actually creates greater stability because any part of the network could fail and it would still, the rest of the network would still be operating. It never brings the whole thing down. And I think, you know, for the few that are, you know, paranoid about the powers that be finding this kind of thing threatening to their control, that's one of the things that they like about it, is that there's no way you can shut this down. You know, as long as there are participants who want to participate and those participants can share their computing resources, their computer, their phone, their whatever, then the system itself can't go down. So that it's actually much more stable from that perspective. But then we have the issue of risk, which you're talking about in terms of currencies that might be, you know, being counterfeit or inflated or, you know, poorly managed or things like that. And, you know, I think that is that's a whole other realm of conversation, but part of how we have completely negated that kind of risk, first of all, one of the components is of our platform is what we call open rules, which means for any currency you're participating in, you always know the rules of that currency. Every transaction that occurs, whether it's in a reputation currency or a monetary currency, notes what version of what currency that transaction was in, and that version has a link to, you know, the rules that you can see. So if you think about it, what are the rules of dollars? What are even the rules of dollars in your bank account? The bank changes the rules all the time. They change the interest rates. They add fees. They do all these different things that you don't even know about it. How can we play a game and succeed at a game if we don't know what the rules are? So open rules is one of those things which tends to put some of the responsibility for risk back on the user. Of do I want to participate in a system that operates by these rules? So that's one aspect of it. But the other thing, remember I mentioned earlier about you actually being an authority for your own account?
Right.
A lot of currencies and even a lot of social movements or whatever, the demise of them sometimes isn't about whether or not it was a well-designed currency or whether or not it was even serving a purpose, but, you know, the organization that was hosting it loses their funding, goes out of business or whatever, or you have bad internal politics in the management or, you know, something like that, and then all the users of that currency suffer because of some other problem of that group that's governing it. In the case of you being able to be an authority of your account, if you are participating in a local currency and it is going in a direction you don't like, or it's, you know, crashing or whatever, but you still like the design of the currency, you still feel like it's meeting an important need for you and your community, the participants can just pick up and say, and basically fork it. Fork it is what we refer to it in software development terms. When you fork code, you can basically say, okay, well, those of us who want to now participate in this other group, carry your balances over with you in this other group, and we'll honor your balances from that currency. And they can't stop you from doing it because it's not centrally controlled. So it really actually gives the end user much less risk because you're in control of your accounts.
That's interesting.
So the reason I think most people assume that we can't be in control is that we're going to lie, we're going to misrepresent the assets we hold to make ourselves rich and jump back in. And I think that what you're describing is a system of interdependencies and encrypted transactions that don't really allow that to happen, but still allow us to manage our information. Can you go
exactly
a little bit deeper into that? Why should this be trustworthy to the outsider, to my counterparty? Why should my counterparty trust that I have what I say I have?
If there's a question about your balance in a reputation currency or a monetary currency, you know, they can ask to see your transaction history, and you should be able to present your whole transaction history in a digitally signed linked chain. And what I mean by that is, if Jerry and I just did a transaction, our transaction actually is signed by both of our digital signatures so that it can't be tampered with. So Jerry can't change his transaction or it'll break my signature, and I can't change the transaction or it'll break his signature. But also inside of that is the link to the ID of each of our previous transactions. So if Jerry previously did a transaction with Kathy and I did one with Lynn, right, and that was our previous transaction, then it's linked to that previous transaction. You can trace that all the way back and make sure that the signatures aren't broken on any of the transactions. And you can't pull one out of the chain or it breaks the links, and you can't insert fake ones in the chain because they won't be linked to. So it builds a kind of data integrity into the structure of the data itself so that it can't be tampered with without breaking the data.
So a couple questions there, and forgive me for diving in, but I think a little bit of depth here will help us all get traction on the idea. If I'm going to show somebody else this chain of transactions, doesn't that expose a lot of information that should be kept private? Like even, you know, sometimes for wiretaps, the government or whoever doesn't actually need to know what was said on the call. They just need to know the pattern of calls and who you were talking with. So if I can identify who I've been transacting with, if I'm going to give that up freely, isn't that an exposure of information that should be kept private, or is there a way to anonymize that while retaining the credibility of the transactors?
It depends on the currency and the rules of that currency. You can always, within a transaction, have additional encrypted data as a payload that only you know how to decrypt. So if you, within your transaction, want to include certain accounting data so that you know how to account for it in your business, or if you have, you know, the contractual data or even content of the transaction, like what you were buying, things like that, that can all be encrypted and not visible. Who the other party is probably going to be visible. And so one of the other options that becomes available in a currency is being able to, for example, have third-party auditors have all transactions be multi-party transactions. So Jerry and I are doing a transaction, and we're attaching a third-party auditor to the transaction. And so now if you want to check my balance, you can check with the third-party auditor, and they can confirm the balance because they have the transaction history, but they're a trusted entity, and I don't have to expose my transactions to just anybody who wants to ask for them.
That makes
it all depends on how you want to set up the rules.
It would be like having a fair transaction witness
along
your side for all your transactions. That's really interesting.
Exactly.
And then if I present a chain of transactions to you, but there's one bad player in there, somebody forfeited something or forged something, or one person that I transacted with broke, and that breaks the chain, what does that do to the integrity of my chain?
Well, they can't break your chain, but they can break their chain.
Mm-hmm.
If you did a valid transaction with them, there's nothing that can invalidate that transaction. It's signed and complete. You both agreed to it. That generally, especially in a digital currency, also is the transfer of the value itself. It's not like you agreed and they didn't pay you, because that transaction is the transfer of the currency. If somebody else starts, disrupting their transactions and that kind of stuff, they can break their chain. But if you have a copy, and when I say you, a lot of people may not want to be the steward of their own data. They may use a third-party broker or, provider or auditor or whatever to be able to hold their data, because they don't want to hold it all on their computer or their cell phone or whatever. So you still have a role of something that can be like a banker or a broker, but they're not in the position of control. You get to select them, and if they aren't serving you, you can pick a different one and still carry everything intact with you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let me just invite Lynn and Rachel, if they have questions, to jump in also. Any questions for you guys?
I have some questions, but Rachel, do you have? Happy to have you go first.
You go ahead, Lynn.
Okay. So Arthur, I did participate in one of your guys' conference calls at one point, and the metacurrency calls, and it's so interesting what you guys are doing. I guess I'm interested in learning a little bit more about if you could give us an example of a meaningful transaction that someone has made, or yourself or someone that you know, that would probably be helpful. And the question of scale and how people are going about creating currencies that actually are fungible outside of a small group of people, or maybe we don't need to do that, but I have the sense there were a couple of people who are involved in the metacurrency project who've really transferred a significant amount of their kind of transaction activities into non-standard currencies. And I'm just interested in learning a little bit more about that.
First, let me say something about the status of the metacurrency project. The thing that we're tackling technology-wise is, it would be an understatement to say it's an ambitious undertaking. So the whole of the technology that we're developing is not complete yet. So there's nobody that is transacting fully inside of the metacurrency framework yet, because the full framework doesn't exist. There are components of it that exist, and that we have some spaces for people to transact in, and all of the people participating around the metacurrency project have been involved with other currencies. And one of the things I do is currency design and consulting, and so there's lots of examples of these kinds of currencies that are happening for real, but they're not happening in the full-blown metacurrency protocols yet. So an example of it being fungible, I think I want to say one thing first, which is my interest in currencies is actually not primarily in monetary currencies, that I think that we're moving in directions away from that. So a lot of the projects that I'm involved in are less so about fungible currencies. One of the big projects that I'm working on right now actually has to do with sustainable fisheries management and setting up a currency for this. I'm working with the New England fisheries, and a currency that the fishermen receive an allocation of points. And there's a fish stock market of sorts where the fish stocks have biological point values. So the fishermen can still manage their own fishing practices, but if they're fishing stocks of fish that are scarcer, they spend their points faster. They lose their points faster to be able to land those fish.
Wow.
And then get paid by the market for those fish. And the market pays out very similarly for all of the fish, so there's not an advantage to them to fish the scarcer stocks. They're not going to get more money for it. They're going to get less money for it. And so it puts the right kind of feedback loops into place. Like, we've got these fictions about markets being self-regulating, but a market can only self-regulate if the right information is being fed back to the participants. So every time a boat lands and fish are unloaded, because of the amount of pounds of fish that are unloaded, the fish stock prices change. And that is visible to all the participants. And when a fisherman is going out to fish, he can see what fish are more affordable in terms of his points budget and be able to take appropriate strategies to target those fish, so that you have the right kind of feedback loops, where currently you don't know what other people are catching. There's no feedback loops, so that the fishermen's practices can actually alter and sustain the fishery.
Right. So this brings up a whole bunch of different things, which sound to me like really viable ways of bringing these currencies to market. Have you heard of the book Branded with an exclamation point, which is basically about NGO brands like Fairtrade and some of the well-caught fish brands and so forth? It seems to me that those brands are beginning to gain a lot of credence in the marketplace. Sometimes there's too many of them, so you get the tyranny of choice, or just too much fuzziness out there. But it seems like connecting up the markets to the brands and so forth would be a really interesting entry path. The NGOs, and I don't know how much of your work has to do with NGOs using these brands to create markets and therefore feedback loops. Is that all in line with what you're doing?
Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned certifications earlier, but something like certified organic, it is a currency that changes the flows of production on the farmer's side, on the food production side, and the flows of consumption on the shopping side, where people will shop in different places or even pay more money to get things that are certified organic. And that's a similar kind of thing. When you can establish a, whether you call that a branding thing or, a certification, a college degree is a kind of certification. We use these things all the time to alter flows. And we just haven't recognized that those are different animals of a similar species, that those are all currencies, that there's rules about how they're issued and how they're redeemed and how they're transacted and, how they function with other currencies.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Thank you. I want to invite other people who are on the call to jump in and ask questions as well.
Yeah, I actually do want to jump in, Jerry. This is Paul B. Hartog. I'm here from the Forward Foundation with Sam Rose. Hello to anybody else who's on the call whom I've worked with. Kathy, I know you're here. We've worked together. I just wanted to point out some interesting things, both in support and with concerns about the metacurrency space. Back in 2005, when Doug Rushkoff and I were having some conversations about alternative currencies, he actually interviewed me on this topic, and it ended up being an article called The Future of Money, which I published on MindJack online. And I talked about the explosion of currencies and the moving towards a plurality of currencies. And one of the things I mentioned in that article was that anybody who could come up with a way for currencies to be created and exchanged would essentially have the killer app of the 21st century. This was the backbone of the new economy. And so since then, a lot of people have been moving into this space. We've seen a lot of players here. And I'm amused by the consistent use of the term flows on this call, because the system that we've created at Forward Foundation is actually called flows, and it addresses what I think is an interesting synergy between what metacurrency is doing and what flows does. So if you want to have a way to add players into a network, there are both objects and relations, and of course some of this language I'm sure will be familiar to Kathy. And so you have rules about how to add new players but you also have to have rules about how to add new relationships between players. And so if you say, here's my standard, everyone adopt it, what you're doing is saying this is a set of rules for bringing in new players. What you want is a set of meta rules that say, here's a way to add new rules. And so I actually do have a question because of my own unfamiliarity with the metacurrency platform, and I know that it's incomplete. But I was hoping that you could tell me a little bit about the metacurrency's ability to be essentially overridden, overhauled, and extended across time. So is this a standard where we adopt it and it solves everything, or is this a standard where we sort of have a social practice and we can change the code over time to allow for new new developments?
Thanks, Paul.
I don't know how geeky to go in the answer, but the metacurrency protocol, well, the metacurrency project consists of four different parts. Rules, a way for currencies to define their rules, including rules of governance and ways that rules can be changed and all that kind of stuff. Because in our reference point for currencies, voting, for example, votes are a currency. There's a way that people can issue their vote and how they're counted and tallied, and you know, it's a kind of currency. So you can actually build decision-making currencies into the governance of currencies at a meta level of the currency itself. So there's rules, there's transport, which basically is the idea, it's sort of like we have with the internet, to allow any node on the network to be able to interact with any other node on the network. And that is the lowest of our priorities because we basically are just using TCP/IP, we're using internet protocols
Got it.
For now. But because of our commitment to have everything be unenclosable and non-centrally controlled, and IP protocols and domain names actually are centrally controlled and governed, they don't meet our requirements. So we're looking at it as a future thing that we still have to be able to provide. And then there's open identity, where you get to create a namespace and being able to have peer resolution of those kinds of things, and open data. And you've heard me talking a little bit about the open data. That has to do with the built-in data integrity. So the idea is that that's pretty low-level protocol type stuff that can be shaped in lots of different manners. We're trying to make it as flexible as possible without falling into the trap of trying to build something that can do everything so it in fact is nothing. In answer to your question, we're trying to make it so that these things are a part of the process of currencies adapting and evolving over time, that you actually say, okay, we have, you know, Denver dollars version 1.1, and now we've just changed the rules and we have version 1.1, and, you know, that kind of thing. And so we actually are building it for the evolution of these systems.
So I've got a bit of a follow-on question to that, Art, which is, I just came back from Italy from a program around microfinance, and one of the speakers there was this guy, Chuck Waterfield, who is really, really interesting, and his mission in life is to go around helping make more transparent the rates and terms for microloans. And he gave a room full of 60 experts in microfinance a very simple test comparing these loan rates. Okay, if you get 2 points at 3% with a declining balance or a flat rate of 2%, blah, 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 blah. He just had three loans up there, and he asked us to raise our hands, which loan would you take? And the smallest number of people picked the best of the loans once you calculated out the APR. So I can see terms changing and terms shifting. My question is, how do you bring these things to the surface in a way that that makes them commensurate so that we can't be scammed? I mean, once we start getting decentralized currencies and changing rates over time and a lot of things moving in the system, I think it's very easy for people not to know what it is they've gotten into or how these things are changing. So is there a piece of the project that's about that?
There isn't at the moment, and I definitely can see a place for that. The dicey thing is the way that we are defining currencies in this broader context, I don't know that you can make them commensurate in any way whatsoever. I mean, our phishing Are fish stock biological value points ever going to be commensurate with college degrees or certified organic or an interest rate on a loan?
Right.
I mean, probably not.
Sorry, Art.
Go ahead. No, good.
I was just going to say maybe this is part of the protocol when two currencies touch and try to become fungible, and maybe there's this fungibility in a handshake that has to happen where they agree on what makes them commensurate. And otherwise they can't shake hands, and therefore they are niche currencies, and that's perfectly okay. But when they want to be exchangeable and when they want to operate relative to fiat currencies, for example, or relative to each other in local exchanges across currencies, maybe then they need to say, okay, here's how you compare and contrast. Because one of the lessons that was driven home really quickly and kind of viscerally with that example that Chuck did was how simple it is to tune a couple terms of the loan, like flat interest versus declining balance interest, and turn those loans into immensely different things. The APR on one was, 129%, the next one was 72%, the last one was, 53%. And it was very simple things, and the term made them either break your back loans or really good loans.
Well, my thinking about what you're talking about is that we are essentially doing our job in the protocol by making those things transparent, and that in the same way that Twitter came out with something that was very simple. And what made the Twitterverse interesting was all of the third-party applications that made things be able to be searched in different ways and organized in different ways and grouped in different ways and that kind of thing. That part of the point of having, a currency, having the open rules, is that you can have a site that does all this kind of analysis on currencies of similar type of things, and you can look those things up and you can see how they translate them and how they're rated by different people and all that kind of stuff. And all of those can be another set of currencies, reputation currencies that those currencies actually have. How much do we like that particular currency or not? So you can get both the qualitative and quantitative information, being able to aggregate about that around that. But that's not something that we're tackling right now.
So you really do need to foster some part of the ecosystem around these around metacurrencies needs to be groups that are working with the transparent data to make it commensurate and to show comparative ratings or whatever else it might be. There's an interesting open source rating agency effort that you can see on the net. I've forgotten its name exactly, but they basically, the first half of their presentation indicts Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch and says, look how stupid this was. And the second part of their presentation explains how we might do a distributed open source rating system. And that's pretty cool. So maybe there's a way for these different efforts to meet in the middle someplace.
Yeah, and that could certainly also be connected to the Currency Designer Guild kind of thing that we were talking about, where mm-hmm. not everybody has the expertise to analyze the design of a currency and say this is what's good, bad, or indifferent about it. So being able to encourage that within a group of people who do that, within a community of practice.
Interesting. Let me invite one or two more questions from the crowd because we had a 15-minute delay. And Art, I'm hoping you can stay with us for a few more minutes.
Sure.
But let me pick a few more questions, and then I'll do a summary at the end. Go ahead. Who is this?
This is Rachel from IFTF, and I was wondering, Arthur, I loved hearing about your passion behind particular applications of this metacurrency kind of project, and you mentioned fisheries earlier. One of the areas where we've been doing some thinking alongside some organizations recently is in the space of caregiving, actually. So we've been working with AARP and United Cerebral Palsy looking at the future of caregiving. And alternative currencies have come up in that application area or that domain when you think of the kind of trust that's really essential for people who are trying to arrange for caregiving long distance for their family members. So that's just one application area that's of interest to me that we've begun to track. And I'm wondering if you had to just kind of tap your passions about it, where you think some of the most interesting projects that you could work on in the next 10 years could be. So you mentioned fisheries, and we've talked about banking. Are there a couple of other domains that you're really interested in or passionate about?
Yes, absolutely. There's a project that I'm working on at the moment that it's called Local Share, and it's basically taking a step into the social economy. It's kind of a mashup of Craigslist and FreeCycle along with social networking to actually, instead of just have those things be anonymous, begin creating a social fabric around being able to share resources more effectively. So not only can you post things to give away or to sell, that kind of thing, but you can also post things to share. And there's different types of sharing being managed from borrow and return or use on site or share it forward. So I can take books that are sitting on my shelves that I, you know, don't look at very often and share them forward into the community and sort of have them actually be cycling in the community and have them be available in a knowledge base there. And we basically create a community-run library in doing that. Books and tools and seeds are some of the things that the first things that Local Share is doing. But I think that is the kind of thing that moves us toward enabling whole new economies outside of the market economy. So that's one of the things that excites me. For me, there's this whole domain, you know, that Local Share, as I said, it has reputation currencies associated with it. There's this whole domain of reputation currencies that I think will be enabling whole new types of economies, and I'm definitely interested in that space and the appropriate ways of formulating those so that they provide kind of built-in sense of direction and order and value and meaning. There's actually a lot. I mean, the whole phenomenon of management of the commons, tragedy of the commons, that kind of thing. That's why I'm excited to be working with the fisheries up in New England, because I think there are approaches to that, to the kinds of resources that we share, that we just need other kinds of feedback loops that market currencies don't give us. Those are some of the key things for me.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I remember from Econ 101 in undergrad wondering how we had dispensed with externalities in a one-hour lecture. And thinking, great Scott, if there's no capillaries in the system, how can any of these people called economists be actually calculating anything? It really made me laugh.
Yeah, that brings to mind one more thing that I want to mention, which is a triple bottom line currency design. Threebles. I'll post the link here.
The Threebles, yeah. Can I invite one more question from somebody who is on the call?
Yeah, this is Sam Rose from Future Forward Foundation. I work with Paul B. Hartzog, who just asked a question a moment ago. And I just wanted to pop in. I had worked over the past 3 or 4 years with some of the folks who started the Bar Camp Bank movement. And we, in around 2004, 2005, 2006, we did lots and lots of research on alternative currency and localized currency and people using currencies online. And we also looked at some of these fungibility questions and the exchange of alternative currencies with fiat currency or with other alternative currencies. And for one thing, I do definitely agree that it's actually more compelling and there's probably more rapid available opportunity for economies that are outside of fiat currency-based economies right now for alternative currencies or metacurrencies. But also, we, at least in the United States, we came across the fact that there's regulation that allows people to create credit union organizations or some form of cooperative-based organization that could maintain these kinds of currencies if they need to have the capacity to be exchanged between one another. You know, if you start exchanging these currencies, then the government will start looking at you. So anyone can create a currency in the United States right now, an alternative currency, and the government will probably leave you alone. But if you start trying to create exchanges, then they will start coming and talking to you about it, especially if you're exchanging it with the dollar or with fiat currency. But this is where, you know, I think there are already some credit unions that are interested in that. And I think that's actually more of a temporary need, because most people who want to do that have a paradigm where they need to do most of their transactions with fiat currency. But if you can make infrastructure available that allows people to do transactions with alternative currency that are meeting some basic survival needs, then they may not have a need to exchange it to fiat currency. So those are just some thoughts and findings that we had from work that I did with Barkhant Bank.
Sam, thank you.
Yeah, Sam,
go ahead.
That's really great. Oh, sorry, can I just say one thing in response to Sam?
Please do.
Yeah, one of the things that we're looking at with metacurrency is some of the rules around banking and everything that are really designed to keep other people out of the space. You have to comply with all of this, you know, all of this stuff. It, even rules around being a third-party record keeper are somewhat stringent. And so when you think about it, though, if you have a technology that makes the person accountable for their own accounts, you're no longer a third-party record keeper or even a bank. People are interacting directly with each other through no central authority. And it creates, I think, it may create a sort of end around, a loophole around a lot of the kinds of restrictions that make it difficult to play in that space right now.
I just want to mention that some of the service organizations that Rachel mentioned seem to be good candidates to adopt alternative currency, like local agricultural associations and the AARP, and those types of organizations seem to be really, a lot of them are interested in it, and a lot of them seem to be a good candidate for somebody to really maintain, you know, a robust alternative currency over time on behalf of individuals that might not be able to manage. They might not have the participatory media literacy to be a self-manager of their own online or digital, you know, currency presence. So that's another thing that me and Paul have come across in our work in the localfoodsystems.org space, where we're working with localized sustainable agriculture people, as service organizations are really interested in this too.
Yeah, one of the nice things about something like metacurrency is any time that an individual chooses not to take responsibility for being the authority for their own financial ecology, they can, of course, proxy that out to these emergent third-party institutions or brokers, right? So by having an open system, then there's always that opportunity for new mediators to step in and help you out.
Was that Paul? Who was
right.
It? Sorry.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay, thank you. Art, any last thoughts? I think we've covered an amazing amount of ground and uncovered way too many questions that I need to dig into after the call. But, yeah, and I know that we've barely scratched the surface, given, you know, the depth of what you know and how big the field is. Any last thoughts, given what we've covered so far on this call?
Just one thing that connects it back to local communities and relocalization. The question earlier was, you know, what domains am I interested in? I also have founded a local business alliance, and it's a Bali network business alliance for local living economies. And we are working locally to basically build our own economic viability among the local business community so that we can have some local currencies and that kind of thing in place. And I think that this will play a big role in that as we encounter difficulties with the dollar and transitions from the industrial age currencies to information age currencies, that being able to build those networks, strong networks inside community for business. And one last thing, you were talking about healthcare and elder care, AARP, and that kind of thing. And I'm assuming that you're familiar with the Furyai Kipu in Japan, where they've created a system of trade of hours of care and have had great success with that in Japan.
Rachel, are you guys familiar with Furyai Kipu? This is a system, as far as I understand it, Art, where I can volunteer to take care of an elderly person in my neighborhood, kind of in exchange as a future, either for care of my elders elsewhere or for myself in later time. Is that right?
Yes.
Wow. I'd love to see a link to some of that on the transcript call.
Cool. We will put a link on the chat shortly.
Excellent.
It's funny, all this reminds me of lots of living system things that keep coming up in different places, including this notion of living water that needs to be in motion. And another book I just finished was a biography of David Bohm called titled Infinite Potential. And he actually invented an experimental language called Rio Mode, which was all flows and no nouns. Wasn't really used that much, but his notion was that our language is very noun and object-centric, and we tend to separate us from each other and from our things. And he was looking for some way to explain or demonstrate the implicate order, the way that we are all interconnected. So I like all these themes as flowing together in wonderful ways. Let me go ahead and, sorry, a couple questions came up in my head, but I think to respect everybody's time, we should wrap this call and let me summarize what we covered so that we can do that. So we started out with 15 minutes of mass confusion and bad audio quality as my attempt to make this call better by going through Skype actually made it worse, so my apologies for that. But once we made it over onto our conference call and started talking, things picked up. So we talked a bit about this whole notion of currencies being currents. There being lots of alternatives to currencies, different kinds. There's targeted currencies, local currencies, community currencies, but even there's also fiat currencies, which we talked about a bit later, but currencies can apply to many more things than just monetary exchange, which was, I think, a big aha during the call. And that currency comes from the word currents, which comes from correre, which is to run or to flow, and that keeping these flows living is really important. So it can be about goods and services and money, but it can be about other sorts of things. Some kinds of currency shouldn't be exchangeable, like reputation currencies, where I get a degree, I shouldn't be able to just give my degree to someone else because that degree is certifying that I know something. So things that are about qualities and skills are probably not transferable. But there's all sorts of currencies available, and Art's definition is that currencies are formal systems for shaping currents, and his definition was a little bit more elaborate than that, but in that general direction. So what happens when currencies get provoked in really small scale, local scale? How do they scale from that to become larger? We talked about the balance between niche-oriented currencies, which might be very appropriate, and larger things. The bigger context here for Art is that living systems need to be, are in fact alive because of their flows. If you picture a human being without any of their flows functioning, or with even one of the flows that goes through not functioning, that human would die. You have a corpse. So we've taken a lot of functioning communities and a functioning planet and functioning organizations, and in many ways we're turning them into corpses by cutting down the flows that exist inside them. So managing the integrity of these flows is really vital to prevent the planet from being a non-living, non-functioning system of flows. We have an evolution of expressive capacity, sort of like language. Language is also a living thing. So money has been a very powerful force shaping a lot of things, and in fact we are still in the age of industrial age currencies, but they've run their course, and we're moving now toward, and this is what's interesting about the Metacurrency Project and Open Money and a bunch of these projects that we're talking about on this call, is that we are in fact experimenting what replaces these industrial age currencies. So in the Depression, in the Great Depression, it turns out that there were thousands of currencies emerged. They were called emergency currencies. And then toward the end, when the New Deal was fashioned, the head of the Fed outlawed all these emergency currencies and drove everybody back toward fiat currency of the U.S. dollar. Change here is really accelerating, and it's going to leave the normal models behind. We didn't have enough time, really, to talk about what that transition might look like. That would be an interesting continuation to our call. But self-organizing systems are showing that they can adapt more quickly. This whole Web 2.0 consciousness is showing that these systems can actually adapt very, very quickly and be more resilient, not less. So there's this slow accretion of self-organizing systems that seems to be working in different ways. We talked then about the Metacurrency Project, where there are new approaches to computing for an open source economy and the ability to create decentralized currencies, where typically these days the bank is the authority on what you own. What if you were the authority on what you own and you had linked chains of signed transactions that were auditable at any point that would prove that you were who you were and you had what you said you were having? So there are now many different ways to join in. There's an ongoing conversation of a currency design guild. There is the New Currency Frontiers effort and a bunch of others. They're trying to keep the ideological discussions off of these sites and really focus more on how to build this platform to create a community of practice of currency designers. This is a pretty global effort. There are participants from Mexico, France, U.S., the Netherlands, and a bunch of other places. Kathy Vian asked whether there's really a digital divide going on here, and also really a big question about risk. Banks are supposed to be managing risk. What happens when you decentralize all this? And I said, well, we tend to confuse centralized control with stability, and that's a quote I'm going to remember for a long time because I believe that very soundly. And decentralization doesn't really compromise sustainability. In many cases, it can create better resilience. So building controls into the architecture and being able to share data is really important. As long as people share resources, the system can't actually go down, sort of like the Internet. There might still be counterfeits or implosions or other kinds of poor management, but as long as the rules are explicit, and this is one of the keys here, how we build the rules in and being able to control and change them and make them transparent, then you're in charge of your own account and you participate with the rules sets that you like and you don't participate with the others. If you don't like the rules or if one of the rule sets breaks because the host loses funding or there's bad internal politics, you can fork away from that and go in other places. So when you're in a transaction, you can ask to see somebody's transaction history, and it should be a digitally signed, unbroken chain that allows that all to be credible. Privacy can be maintained by actually creating layers of encryption within the transaction chain, so you wouldn't have to expose necessarily all the different parties in the transaction. If there's one bad player in your chain, then they're a bad transactor, but your chain retains its integrity because the transactions themselves are already signed. Lynn Jeffrey jumped in and asked about what are examples of meaningful transactions that have been made using metacurrency or these other projects? And I said, well, the status is that the metacurrency project is really ambitious and the technology is still incomplete, so that you can't transact inside the system yet. These are all currency design consultants working together to build the system. But in fact, Art is not primarily interested in fungible currencies. For example, he's working with sustainable fisheries management in the northeast of the U.S. to do fish stock management, bringing a whole new meaning to fish stock, where you would assign biological point values to different kinds of fish, and as the fishermen bring them into market, they would actually find that the fish that they fish increment or decrement their ability to keep fishing in those areas. The value is actually directly related to the biological stress on that particular fish stock. So there's another fiction that Art pointed out, which is that markets are all self-regulating. Well, this is only true if there are the right feedback loops in here. And I hosted a call about the commons a couple of days ago where we talked about Eleanor Ostrom and her notions about the management of the commons. And one of the points that came up there was that there are many different kinds of commons and different sorts of regulatory regimes needed, some simple, some very complicated. Art also mentioned that college degrees, for example, are different forms of currency. Organic certifications are currency. And we need to figure out how to alter these flows to make those markets really work. Paul Hartzog jumped in for the Forward Foundation and talked about some work that he had done about the plurality of currencies and an exchange for those currencies possibly being the killer app of the new regime. But how do you add new players? How do you build new relationships? How do you manage the flows? And also his question was partly, how can you overhaul metacurrencies over time? Can you change the social practices? And that's where Art pointed out that the rules of governance here really matter. And he pointed out something I'd never thought about, but that voting is a kind of currency as well. And the how votes are counted and the relative weight of votes is part of the rules of a voting currency. In fact, some of the aspects of the Internet don't really meet these requirements of openness and transparency and decentralization, most notably the assigning of Internet addresses and names. I asked whether these different kinds of regulatory regimes, even if transparent, could be made commensurate so that people couldn't be easily fooled. I saw an example recently of experts in the field of microfinance who couldn't pick apart the best of three different loan terms, which had very few terms to them. And there's room here for third-party applications to do this because the data will be transparent, but it's not really a part of the metacurrency project, as I understand it, to build that kind of commensurate measurement into it. Rachel asked about other sorts of application areas. Her question was about caregiving, but what other domains might this be applicable to? And Art mentioned a project called Local Share, which is creating local economies, sort of a combination of social network and Craigslist and Freecycle to share books, tools, and other sorts of things, really soaking up some of the local social surplus, to borrow a phrase from Clay Shirky, which we didn't bring up during the call. Second area would be reputation currencies, creating new types of economies. How do you formulate those, and what do they work like? And then the third, going back to the fisheries, commons management. How does this all work? He pointed us also to the triple bottle lime currency of treble. Sam Rose from the Ford Foundation mentioned Barkamp Banks that he's been working with from 2004 through 2006. They did a lot of research on alternative and local currencies. And part of their research uncovered that in the United States, for example, you can create credit unions and co-ops and others to maintain or govern some of these currencies, but the government shows up and starts looking over your shoulder when you create exchanges. We didn't mention, I just made a side note to myself, we didn't mention in this call in-game currencies for these virtual worlds, which are getting pretty big, nor did we mention air minutes, where in the third world and developing countries, the number of minutes on your phone and phone-to-phone pay systems are becoming a really important way to transact, mostly of fiat currencies. But those air minutes also become a proxy for fiat currencies. Art says that banking rules in many ways are designed to keep others out of the space, and maybe there's a way to sort of work around the systems, creating things that are not fungible but that actually create the basis for these decentralized resilient currencies. Especially if people can be accountable for their own accounts and there isn't a third party or central authority who can dictate the terms. Sam Rose jumped back in and said that service organizations might be really good candidates here, pointing toward local agricultural organizations, AARP, and a variety of others. Then Paul jumped back in and said, look, anytime somebody chooses not to be responsible for their transaction, they can proxy it out. So Art, at the end of the call, said, look, there's a lot of ways here to connect local businesses and to create strong networks inside communities. There's one project he's involved in called Bali, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. He also pointed to Furiai Kipu in Japan, which is a way of taking care of elderly in exchange. It's sort of a currency about taking care of elderly in exchange for being taken care of oneself when one is actually older. That is the end of today's call about alternative currencies. This is our debut FutureCast call held on November 20th, 2009. Thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for your patience early on the call. Please feel free to tell others about these calls and to let us know how to make them better. We're open for ideas. Thank you very much, Art, and thank you, everyone else, for diving in. For Kathy Vion and IFTF, I'm Jerry Mikulski, and we'll talk to you on the next call. Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of FutureCast, IFTF's ongoing podcast series. We publish these shows under the Creative Commons Attribution License. You can learn more at our website at iftf.org.